KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Because the state's official pot consultant is still working to estimate marijuana consumption here. Last fall, Washington and Colorado became the first states to legalize the sale of taxed marijuana to adults over 21 at state-licensed stores. Looks like we won't have as many cherries in Washington this year, but the ones we do get will be bigger. Northwest cherry growers expect a 2013 crop of 18 million boxes. That's well short of last year's record of 23 million, but the average cherry size should be larger. And the harvest expected to start sooner. Growers and marketers from Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Utah released their crop estimates this week. Washington is the largest producer with an expected crop of 14 million boxes. The president of the Northwest Cherry Growers and the Washington State Fruit Commission says the crop will be smaller because of the cool, windy weather in the pollination period, but he expects that the quality will be high. A Washington woman whose car was stolen from her apartment complex actually saw the stolen SUV hours later waiting in the drive-thru of a fast food restaurant where she works. According to the Tri-City Herald, Virginia Maiden called police Tuesday after seeing her SUV in the drive-thru. Officers arrested the 22-year-old Kennewick woman who was driving. In the car, police found clothes that had been stolen from department stores. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
57 degrees in Seattle. National Weather Service reckons it's going to be partly sunny today with a chance of showers and an afternoon high of 66. Support for NPR comes from Carbonite, providing automatic cloud backup solutions for individuals and small businesses. Learn more at carbonite.com.
Support from Washington State Patrol.
It's 10:06. I'm Bernard Ouellette. KUOW is listener-supported public radio. Thanks so much for your support. If you're not a member yet, why not do it today? Just go to KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical till October. David Stern and the NBA Board of Governors have spoken, and the Sacramento Kings remain the Kings. They stay in California, but our civic leaders say they're going to hold steady to the memorandum of understanding with would-be basketball team owner Chris Hansen. One of those public leaders is King County Executive Dow Constantine, and he's with us today. Hello.
Hi, Marcy.
Nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
On Monday, Mayor Mike McGinn was here, and he says that the memorandum of understanding is in place for 5 years. So what does yesterday's decision by the NBA Board of Governors mean for that?
Well, obviously, it's disappointing, but it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean any changes in our understanding, our agreements with the city or with Chris Hansen and his group. We always knew that this could take a long time. At the outset, we didn't really know about the Sacramento situation that arose after we came to agreement with Hansen and with the city of Seattle. And, you know, so we have a long-term agreement, and I think Chris is going to continue to look for ways to bring NBA basketball back to Seattle as well as bring NHL hockey, and we are going to be ready when he does.
One of our listeners on Monday wondered whether the Hansen group should pursue hockey first as opposed to basketball.
I don't think hockey could support a new arena by itself. And famously, you know, the Seattle Center Coliseum, now Key Arena, is not set up for NHL hockey and would have to have some serious work done on it. So I don't know the finances of all that. And also, you know, folks have different interests. These investors are very interested personally in basketball. There are other investors who are hockey people, and there may be some who share interest in both. I'm not in that part of the deal, and I wouldn't pretend to understand all those intricacies. But I do know that Seattle, there's a lot of interest in this town around hockey. I wasn't aware of how extensive it was until this began sort of surfacing a couple years ago, and folks started contacting me, you know, stopping me on the street and talking about how excited they would be to have an NHL franchise here.
Right. I'm assuming the NHL's in worse shape financially than the NBA is, so they're not looking to expand their league either, I wouldn't imagine.
You know, I don't know a lot about the situation with the league, but I do know that there are some teams that have been kind of dragging along. The Phoenix Coyotes, who aren't in Phoenix but are in Glendale, Arizona, one example. But there's a, an appetite here for hockey. It's a much, much bigger market than many of the places that either the NHL or NBA currently have franchises. And I think that we're one of those few places that can support both of those and many other sports and entertainment franchises successfully. I, you know, counsel people who are upset about the Sonic situation that, you know, we need to have some patience. I understand people are anxious to get basketball back, but Chris Hansen is a man who's shown himself to be level-headed and determined. And I know that Steve Ballmer and the Nordstroms as well understand that sometimes it takes a while to make something good happen. And just hang in there with them, with the city and the county. And I still believe that eventually we're going to get this done.
So you think that, the Hansen group is in it for the long haul?
I think so. You know, I've gotten to know Chris a little bit more over the course of the last few months. And he seems to me someone who wants to do this for the right reasons. He wants to bring basketball back to, you know, the town of his birth, what he considers to be his hometown. And he, like I, has fond memories of being a kid down there at the Coliseum and watching his Sonics play. And, you know, there are an awful lot of folks who are an awful lot younger than me.
Really?
Who are deeply invested in this. You see the young people in their Sonics gear. It's become a real cause in around town, not just those of us who are wistful for the 60s or 70s, but people who want to have basketball back now have that as their kind of primary sport. And, you know, that's great. Everybody's got different interests, and this is one that I think we can have successfully operate in this town.
Just a last question about this, which I found interesting. I believe it was in the Seattle Times on Sunday. They were, it might have been Danny Westneat in a column, talking about how Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer in particular, the Nordstroms haven't been so public in what they've said about this, have thrown not just money around, but weight around and have played not as nice as the Seattle reputation is and not as nice as we were, you know, when the Sonics became the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think that's their name.
The NBA is a tough business. And even though these guys, including Chris, who doesn't live here anymore, but these guys all have kind of that same Seattle approach to things, Steve Ballmer less than the others, you do have to kind of go elbows out when you're playing in that league. And both on and off the court. And I think that they have, you know, done that in a way that's still consistent with the way folks conduct themselves around here. I have to tell you a kind of a humorous incident from earlier in the week. There's a rally up at Numo's on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. And I get to get up on this stage and, you know, cheer on the crowd. And one of the folks on stage give a big shout out, asking the crowd to respond in kind to the Nordstroms, which is the first time I've ever heard Nordstroms name checked from the stage at Numo's and all the, you know, dozens of times I've been there. Fascinating.
Well, there you have it. It's the not-so-strange bedfellows that happen in Seattle. We're talking with King County Executive Dow Constantine, making a monthly visit. And if you have a question, you can call 206-543-5869 when we release the phone lines, or 1-800-289-5869. Our email is weekday@kuow.org. On a totally, I suppose I could make a tenuous connection here, but I won't. Hundreds of people packed a meeting on Tuesday night. The subject was potential proposed cuts to Metro bus service. 17% cuts in service could take effect as early as next year if state lawmakers don't give King County a new transit funding option. Dow Constantine, walk us through again why the proposed cuts are on the table in the first place.
So transit is funded by fares and by primarily sales tax, a 0.9-cent sales tax. That sales tax replaced other transportation taxes that were eliminated by initiatives many years ago, inadvisedly, but eliminated. So the sales tax is very volatile. During this recession, it just collapsed, and we lost a lot of the money it took to keep the buses on the road. And even as the economy comes back, sales taxes are recovering more slowly. Mm-hmm. They're never going to recover to their previous levels. And when they do, we will have lost all of that revenue during that interim period. The legislature was persuaded because of reforms we've made in Metro, because of our new way of allocating bus service based on productivity and fairness, to grant us a two-year $20 vehicle license fee called the congestion reduction charge that, when paired with our remaining reserves, kept the buses on the road for these 2 years. That charge runs out, the authority for it runs out early next year. At that time, our reserves will be gone, the charge will be gone, facing a 17% cut in bus service. What that means is the elimination of about 65 routes, another 86 significantly reduced, and the impacts will be to most of the folks who use the system. Three or four out of every five riders will see their commute deteriorate. So the legislature needs to give us some alternative funding mechanism to impose locally in order that we might keep the buses on the road.
Well, I'm going to go to the legislature in just a second. I want to talk about where and how you decided what cuts to propose. Mm-hmm. Were you looking... Was this going to be equitable throughout the service area? Are you looking at least used routes?
Yeah. So we had a countywide stakeholder group a few years ago that really started from scratch and thinking about how new service hours would be allocated or reductions would be made if necessary. And instead of the old sort of political arm twisting that led to the creation of routes in the first place, many of which go back to when it was just Seattle Transit, mm-hmm. you know, they said, look, the most important thing is how much value, transportation value, are we getting for each tax dollar. So productivity measured in various ways is the first thing. But also something called geographic value, which means, you know, everybody's in this system. Everybody should have access to some kind of service. And then equity and social justice, the thought that, you know, for some people, the bus system is their only alternative, the only way they can get that education, get that job, get a leg up. So those went into a set of formulas and a way to objectively measure what kind of service we're delivering. So in our April 1st service guidelines report, it showed, you know, using those criteria and the $75 million shortfall we're going to face, which routes would need to be eliminated or reduced in order to, you know, still get the most value out of what we have. You know, it can be highly efficient and yet a completely inadequate level of service in a time when more and more people are moving to the bus.
Well, the idea is to have people stay with the bus, given climate change and various other factors.
Well, and just traffic. I mean,
right.
If you move tens of thousands of cars back onto the road, it is going to be a nightmare for every commuter out there, for freight, for our economy.
Just one last question about service before we talk about the legislature. The Metro is in the midst of rolling out new rapid ride routes while we're talking about cuts. So are those the kinds of things that stay put?
Those were approved by the voters. There was a tenth of a cent increase in the transit sales tax a few years ago. And those are actually really productive routes because they're in these corridors. Mm. So rather than the big spider web that goes to everybody's front door, you have everybody come to the corridor, whether it's Highway 99 between Federal Way and Tukwila, or the route between Bellevue and Redmond, or Ballard and West Seattle. A lot of folks come to a central location. It can run much more efficiently, carry more people, and get more of that productivity. So those are actually probably more of the model of the future.
So more like light rail.
And more like emulating what you get when you have a fixed rail system.
So you mentioned, because I love this, a new transit funding option. What is the new transit funding option that you would like the legislature to allow?
Well, we worked with all of the cities in the county and came up with, first of all, agreement on the problem statement, both with transit and with our decaying road system throughout our 39 cities and in the unincorporated county. And we presented to the legislature a proposal, an idea for how we could have the local authority to begin fixing that. We asked for 1.5% motor vehicle excise tax authority. We asked for the ability of city councils and the county council to levy some existing authority we have through council action for vehicle license fee, through council action rather than through sending it out on the ballot.
So they would cede that right and just give it to the council. The council could.
So, you know, yeah, right now, we're getting really into the weeds here, but I'll try to make this simple. Right now, every city and county has the ability to impose under statute a vehicle license fee. That's a flat fee on every vehicle up to $100. Hmm. $20 of that can be done by the council. The other 80 has to go out to a vote. Our request was that they increase that $20 to $40 so that it could actually fund some paving and you know, pothole filling, that sort of thing. So that was the second thing. The third was, if the state imposed a statewide gas tax, please allocate some of it to local jurisdictions to pave the roads as they have in the past when they've imposed a gas tax.
Well, this is a year where lawmakers came into Olympia disavowing tax hikes, including the governor and many Democrats. So why would they be well disposed to authorizing a transit funding option?
Well, there are good, strong economic reasons for us to invest in transportation now. Losing 17% of our bus service is going to hurt the economic recovery. It's going to hurt people's prospects individually, but it's going to hurt the economy of the region. And the economy of the region drives the economy of the state. We have only 29 or 30% of the people here in King County. We have fully half the economy, half the payroll is here. That's what pays the taxes to pay for, you know, the schools and the roads and everything else all around the state. If you decide to put a drag on our economic recovery here, you're putting a drag on the entire state's economy and our prospects for competing nationally and internationally. So, you know, there's a anti-tax sentiment among pretty much all Republicans and some Democrats. We're not asking them to increase taxes. We're asking them to free the people of King County to invest in the infrastructure we need to succeed. That is all we're asking.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned how King County is the driver. There are a lot of people that talk about the opposition to things in King County on a principal basis. And I know there are some people who've said, well, let's just, you know, allocate the money that goes to the state by how much is given
right
per county. And so that many of the projects in outlying areas and perhaps eastern Washington would be unfunded.
And, you know, it always comes back to that. Why don't we just each county, each city, keep the tax money raised there? We could make the level of investments that people here expect in order to protect their quality of life in the physical infrastructure, like the roads or the buses, but also mm-hmm. in the natural infrastructure, like restoring the salmon runs or preserving open space. And also, I have to say, in the human infrastructure and things like our schools and our universities that are being cut back by
right.
the state, I think most of the people here in King County believe in those investments as the foundation for our prosperity and our quality of life. On the other hand, we are one state, and I continue to believe that we need to view ourselves not just as this, you know, forward-looking, successful region that competes with other economic regions globally, but also as part of this, you know, compact that we've made with people across the state from end to end. And we need to figure out how to work together in order to improve the prospects for everyone.
Well, you've been in the legislature. I mean, it's been a little while since you were down there in Olympia. But, you know, it's an interesting relationship, I suppose, what happens in Olympia and how it affects us and vice versa. So looking at it now in 2013, when, you know, they haven't made much progress on most of yeah. the big issues, including transportation, including the budget, why should they, or do you have any hope, I suppose, that they will consider this, that they will make this transit funding option a priority?
Well, you know, I have to have hope that that's possible because it is unarguably the key to keeping this economic recovery going, along with them stepping up to the responsibility to invest in education. I have to believe that people didn't run for office simply to, you know, dismantle the institutions we've created, destroy the infrastructure that we've inherited, that they fundamentally ran for office because they wanted to help our, you know, state and its people succeed. And putting these responsibilities before them, they're not being asked to break some, you know, silly pledge they made never to raise taxes or fees. They're being asked to allow us to have local authority to make decisions for ourselves that will, in fact, benefit everyone across the state.
You have good lobbyists down there?
We have really good lobbyists down there. We have an in-house representative, and then we contract, and every couple of years we put out for bid contract with lobbyists who have multiple clients in Olympia. So, and plus the county council and I and our city partners are in Olympia all the time. Working with legislators and trying to, you know, help them understand the challenges we face as local governments.
So back to this public hearing that you moved to the train station mm-hmm. because you didn't have room for the, I think I've read differing numbers, but about 400 people. Yeah. Were you there?
I was not. That was a county council hearing.
So you're not allowed to come to those?
Well, it's I don't want to step on the council members' toes. That was their show, and it was a really important thing to do to give the people the opportunity to come out and testify. Councilmember Phillips leads the committee that deals with transit and transportation. And, you know, as expected and as happened 2 years ago when this congestion reduction charge, this temporary fee, right. was in the works, hundreds of people came out to say, we, our families, our community depend on this transit service. It is penny wise and pound foolish to cut it. And I think that message ought to get through to our representatives, particularly the King County legislators in Olympia.
In fact, it seemed, I was not at the public hearing, but in coverage of it, it seemed that that really was the message, that none of the county council members themselves were surprised. I don't think anybody stepped up and said, yay, cut Metro service 17%. Everybody was opposed to it. So it seemed like the message was, look, here's our citizenry and we're asking you to do this.
Yes. And, you know, this is, there are folks who are you know, sort of more enthralled to the right-wing anti-tax fervor. But on the county council, there were seven of the nine members, including, even though it's nonpartisan, including two Republicans, who voted in favor of that $20 congestion reduction charge, voted in favor of keeping our buses on the road. And, you know, as is always the case when people do the right things for the right reason, that has not been particularly politically damaging to them. In fact, if anything, it has been helpful because people see them as folks who can rise above politics and serve the needs of their constituents.
Our phone number 206-543-5869, or you can email us weekday at kuow.org. We're going to take a short break and be back with Dow Constantine in just a minute on Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Reclaiming Prosperity, a new town hall speaker series beginning with Inequality and the Future of Work on May 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Panelists David Madland, Annette Bernhardt, and David Warren discuss income inequality and rebuilding middle-class prosperity. More at townhallseattle.org.
58 degrees, partly sunny in Seattle. Forecast says chance of showers through the day, afternoon high of 66.
Did you know you can support KUOW through a planned gift? By making a planned gift, you help ensure that public radio remains available in our community for years to come. For more information on how you can make a planned gift to KUOW while receiving financial benefits today, go to kuow.org/future.
1028, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Music and comedy in the golden age of radio in about 10 minutes.
From KUOW, this is Weekday, and our guest is King County Executive Dow Constantine. We're talking about the legislature and Metro. And
I was ranting about that.
You were ranting, all fired up and ready to go. But just the last question, if the legislature doesn't do anything this session and waits until next year, will that be too late?
That will be too late.
Okay.
The tax would need to be... especially if they require a public vote, would need to be on the ballot this year in order that we can begin collecting it next year in time to prevent the cuts. We don't have a lot, as I mentioned before, have reserves anymore because part of the deal was we'd pay down our reserves so in order to keep the buses on the road. So when the money's gone, it's gone, and the cuts are going to have to go into effect, and that is going to be a considerable problem.
Does that have any impact on the except for if more cars were on the road. What is the state construction on 99?
The construction on 99 is a big challenge with regard to transit. In the first phase, which was the south portion down to Spokane mm-hmm. Street, the state provided mitigation funding. So that we were able to add a lot of buses, and a lot of people in West Seattle and south of there moved to those buses, and that has reduced the problem with congestion, the tie-ups. For the center section that's starting now, there is no such mitigation because part of the original deal was we were supposed to get motor vehicle excise tax authority to put more buses on the road.
Wow.
The project came. The authority never came. So when those buses are done, they're done. And unless we get new authority, the second phase is going to be considerably more difficult than the first was.
Karen writes in, how is the funding of Metro affected by funding and overlap of Sound Transit?
You know, it's not really. I mean, unless you get to the issue of overall regional capacity, economic capacity. Sound Transit has its own set of authorities that were created under the Regional Transit Authority legislation a couple decades ago. And those have been voted on by the people and approved twice. Sound Transit 2 approved several years ago. We're now starting conversations around Sound Transit 3, but that's going to be quite a ways off because, again, of the capacity issue. Mm-hmm. Some of the taxes from the first go-around and the second go-around will need to start to be retired in order for there to be capacity to keep building light rail and the other projects that are needed to really, you know, move large numbers of people highly efficiently and in a predictable amount of time.
This is its whole other subject, and we do talk about transit all the time. I guess it's a concern when we talk about taking growth and building light rail. And I know Bellevue, that leg of Sound Transit is, at least as I understand it, going ahead. That's finally been approved. So we're talking about creating a network. We've talked a lot about the interconnectivity of all these various services and streetcars in Seattle is yet another thread that's separate. The idea that we want them all coordinated somehow, shouldn't they be funded in that same kind of coordinated manner?
Well, you could say that same thing about everything we do in this state.
I guess
a lot
I
of
could.
Things are driven by the funding sources that were created by different legislatures, by different initiatives over the years. And yes, if we were able to start again from scratch, I would recommend having things be far less complex, far more rational, and have your democratically elected legislative officials in Olympia and locally be able to prioritize things rather than have all these constraints that keep them from being able to use the money the most efficient way.
I know you live and work here, but when you get together with your peers around the country, is everybody else suffering from the same sort of complexity of funding?
No. I think we here have among the most complicated systems of governance of any place I've ever found in the country. When I tell people that I am the executive of a county with 2 million people that has 39 cities and zillions of special purpose districts, fire and hospital and sewer and water, folks from back east and other parts of the country are amazed and bewildered. It's, part of our culture here in a way, and it's also a vestige of the political climate at the time when the state was founded. But it is not a good way to run things. And, if step back a little ways, it'd be great to be able to convene, the sort of constitutional convention and say, okay, guys, 21st century, can we do this a little more rationally now?
And yet you want this job for another 4 years.
Well,
it's stunning, isn't it?
I appreciate the sympathy. I think that I've learned enough to be able to really add some value to this. And despite all the constraints and frustrations, it is wonderful to be able to do things that are going to be a benefit to people for generations. That is very, very satisfying.
Doug Constantine is King County Executive. Now here's a happy piece of news. The county recently agreed that it was going to buy some land on Squawk Mountain from a logging company, I believe. Can you explain the details?
Speaking of things that are going to benefit people for generations. So Squawk Mountain and Cougar Mountain in the Cascade Foothills are very popular recreation areas. Squawk Mountain has some land kind of on its slopes or at its base that has been a longtime forest camp and was recently sold to a logging company that proposed to clear cut it, to log it off, which would have had a big impact on recreation in the area as well as, water heading down toward May Creek. It's the headwaters of May Creek, 7 mile long creek and salmon stream. So we didn't have the money right away. The voters of King County have approved funding sources to save valuable open space for themselves mm-hmm. and future generations, but we don't have a big pot of money to spend on this. But the Trust for Public Land came in. They reached an agreement with the landowner. They need to finish the appraisals and come up with a final purchase price, but then the Trust for Public Land will buy and hold the property, and then King County has an agreement with the Trust to buy it back from them so they can then take their money and move on to another project and save another valued open space. This is one of the best things about my job, that we see these things. Everyone wants to save them. I have the ability to move the agenda and make it happen.
How long does King County have to pay it off?
I don't know the exact schedule, but the transaction begins with the trust closing on the property in February of 2014. And conveying a portion of it to King County when the county has its initial funds for the first phase of the purchase. And then we'd buy it in pieces after that.
214 acres, am I right about
that? It's 216 acres. 16. And, a sidelight to this, adjacent to this property nearby is Cougar Mountain, and really our most popular hiking trails in the county. Like 100 people a day all year round come there and hike. On May 1st, the 50th anniversary of the first American ascent of Mount Everest, I was able to rename two trails on Cougar Mountain after those who summited: Jim Whitaker, my West Seattle High School fellow alumnus, and Noang Gambu, his climbing partner. And so now the two trails are the Whitaker Wilderness Peak Trail and the Gambu Wilderness Cliffs Trail, and they converge at the top of Wilderness Peak. And it is a wonderful reminder for all those people who hike there of the accomplishments of Jim Whitaker and his partner, and also maybe a little bit aspirational. Once they get out there and hike, they want to take on something bigger. Jim, I think, was very happy with it. He helped me with the naming idea. And I think we should be proud that our community produced someone who had the vision to get out there and conquer the world's highest peak.
So it doesn't require a view that you go with him on some kind of massive climb up Mount Rainier or something.
I have not yet signed up for that.
Mm. Have you climbed Mount Rainier?
I haven't. It's one of my goals. I was laughing about Steve's sabbatical. There's no sabbatical in my job. I think you get a sabbatical when you lose. And then, I can climb Mount Rainier at that time.
Well, speaking of lost, just the last question. This is tomorrow, I believe, is the filing deadline for public office.
Yes.
I said you were running, so I'm assuming that
yes.
You're going to file the papers. Do you have any opposition?
I filed for re-election on Monday. Two people have come forward and said that they are also running, and I welcome them. And I will be running a vigorous campaign. It's kind of, the part of the gig is you have to raise the money and do the campaigning in order to get elected and be able to, serve the people. And it's just part of the deal. So I got the full-time job being executive and the full-time job being the candidate. And that goes through November.
And while you are campaigning, you are likely to be on hiatus from our airwaves. So this might be the last time that we talk to you for a little while. Dow Constantine, King County executive, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
At 10:38, we're going to step back into the past to learn about music and comedy in old-time radio in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Evergreen Speech and Hearing Clinic in Bellevue, Kirkland, and Redmond, celebrating Better Hearing and Speech Month with free hearing consultations to help transform lives through the resolution of hearing loss with hearing instrument technology and customized care programs. More information at everhear.com.
59 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 66 this afternoon. Forecast says partly sunny with a chance of showers. Then it's going to be cloudy overnight, dropping down to 52. Tomorrow, Friday, cloudy all day with a chance of showers and a high of 63.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company. This month, Soaring Heart is featuring its handmade all-organic pillows for kids in honor of Seattle Children's Purchase a Miracle campaign. More information is available at their Fremont showroom or online at SoaringHeart.com.
1039, I'm Bernard Ouellette. New rules for the growing and selling of legal marijuana in Washington state are expected to be released today. KOW's Amy Radel tells us more about that in 25 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles speaking from London. King County.
And now, through the magic of radio, we head back into the golden age of radio. Katie Sewell, I'm here and I'm not here. How is that possible?
I have no idea.
It's because it's just one big comedy fest. That's what it is.
I think it's your overwhelming passion for the golden age of radio takes you from your sabbatical back into the studio.
I had to be here because you know how much I love it. So, all right, Katie, I know that we just listened to a little music there and a little comedy. We heard a little bit of Bob Hope because, you're thinking about music and comedy these days?
I am. Comedy shows during the Golden Age almost always had a song in the middle, as you well know. And in fact, it's almost as if they thought a comedy show wouldn't be right if they didn't throw a song in the middle of it. I don't know how that became the formula, but that was the formula. But the singers that they hired to sing in the middle aren't necessarily actors. At least not when they start out as just being the hired musical guest, right? Let's take Doris Day, musical guest on Bob Hope's show.
Here's the gal who was selected as the Orchid Queen of the National Flower Festival, our singing orchid, Miss Doris Day.
Every day I love you just a little bit more.
Doris Day is just a singer back then, before she did all those pillow movies with Rock Hudson and the like.
Well, that's the thing about radio. It turns out that Doris Day not only could sing, she actually had decent comedic timing.
I'm not surprised about that. She was a good comedian.
Let's listen.
Oh, Doris, this pain is awful.
Oh, is it really that bad, Bob? Let me look at your leg. Oh, my gosh, it's all twisted out of shape, isn't it?
That's the wrong leg.
That's pretty good. I like that.
So when she was asked later on in her life what she learned about acting from Bob Hope, she said not to step on his lines. but remember, these singers were not actors. So when they turned out to be really good at acting, it was a really nice surprise. Let's take another singer, shall we? Frances Langford.
You've got me reaching for the moon. I know the moon is far away. Why should I try to reach the moon?
I don't know Frances Langford.
You do know her. You just know her in a very different context. Let us consider the role that she played on the radio. She stepped into playing Blanche opposite Don Ameche on the show The Biggersons.
We're not going to fight on Christmas Eve, no matter what happens. Remember, you promised.
Okay.
I'm not even going to get mad because you didn't send me a Christmas card.
I did send you a Christmas card.
It isn't necessary to make excuses or alibis, John. I'm going to forget it entirely.
I don't have to make excuses. I did send you a Christmas card. I mailed it 5 days ago.
I never received it.
Well, then it got lost in the mail.
That's possible.
Thank heaven.
All the other cards came.
That doesn't mean anything. One card can get lost, can it?
If you sent it.
I did send it. I swear I sent it. Had a wonderful poem on it. A beautiful picture. Was trimmed with lace. Cost me a buck.
All right, John.
But do you believe me?
Let's not discuss it anymore.
Okay.
But I hope you don't forget to send one next year.
She's remembered for doing that.
And it's great to hear Don Ameche in that role because, you know, Don Ameche had that long career. Then he kind of disappeared for a while. Then he shows up again as an old man in Cocoon and Cocoon 2. And then he had a whole string of great
hits. I would
hits.
Not have remembered that. That is, I'm going to have to go watch that again, actually.
I think that he was He was a movie star and then a radio actor.
Mm-hmm. And to think that Frances Langford started as just a, you know, singer for hire, and then all of a sudden it turns out she was a great comedic talent.
That's great. All right, so who else did this?
Well, Jack Benny.
Jack Benny,
of course.
This, yeah.
He's the master of hiring musicians and then trying to mold them into comedians. And he didn't restrict it to his singers, as you all know. His band leader, Phil Harris, turned into a regular character on his show. And when he hired the tenor Owen Patrick McNulty to perform every day, Jack not only turned him into a comedian, he changed his name into Dennis Day.
Well, don't you even want to hear my song for tomorrow's show?
No, I don't.
But it'll cheer you up.
All right. Go ahead and cheer me up.
I've changed my mind.
Dennis, sing that song.
Okay, what a sore head.
That was a great relationship, mm-hmm. those two, because it was so odd.
He was very good. Same with him and Phil, actually, when you think back to that show. Well, singer Dennis Day and bandleader Phil Harris both eventually got their own radio comedy shows.
Yeah, Phil Harris had his own comedy show, yep. and it was he and his partner. I can't remember, Alice Faye. They did it for a long time.
Yep, so they... Musicians molded into comedians. Thanks, Jack Benny. He also considered his band to be a very important part of his audience. For example, he kept a guitarist in the band named Frank Remley just because he had a great laugh. Not because he was a great guitar player, but because he had a great laugh, and he would spontaneously laugh at his jokes so loudly that it encouraged the audience members to do the same. So when Phil Harris gets his own show, the Phil Harris, Alice Faye show, he takes Frank Remley with him in the band and then started using him as a character in his scripts.
He just wants me to fire five of the guys. But the worst part of it is that one of the five is Remley.
Oh, no, Phil. No, not Frankie. You can't fire your best friend.
Well, I don't want to fire him, but Mr. Scott insists. He says Remley is the worst guitarist in the world.
That's not true. Is it?
Of course not. Frankie ain't the worst guitarist in the world. He only sounds that way when he plays.
You know, and just to wrap things up, Steve, I love it when there's a case of you don't even remember that this comedic actor started out as a musician in the first place. Shall we consider Ozzie and Harriet?
What do you have there, dear?
Oh, I was just rummaging around upstairs a bit, and I thought the boys might make a costume out of these old work pants.
Gee, Pop, they're pretty dirty. Not only that, dear, they're covered with paint.
Well, what do you expect, Harriet? I wore them when I painted the breakfast nook.
I think you did a better job on the pants than you did on the breakfast nook.
Burn.
Ooh. Well, Ozzie Nelson was a band leader when he started out his career, just like Phil Harris. And Harriet Hillard was a vocalist. Let's listen to what she used to sound like.
The moon is high, the sky is blue, and here am I, but where are you?
So this is Harriet from the Ozzie and Harriet show. She used to be an ingenue singer.
Yep.
Oh, that's pretty funny. I just see her and Ricky and David and Ozzie on TV in my mind.
Well, after Ozzie and Harriet got married, they both started appearing on the Red Skelton show. And when Red Skelton was drafted, Ozzie and Harriet became a show themselves. They were given a show to fill the gap, first on radio and then eventually on TV because people liked it and it stuck around. But by all accounts that I read, people said that Ozzie remained a band leader in his heart the whole way through his career. He always had a bigger band working on his show than most people did. And he always kept an eye on things. And his trumpet player, Billy May, was interviewed, and he said, he put it this way, I guess he was covering himself just in case the show folded. He could always go back on the road as a band leader.
Musicians, comedians, band leaders. All right, Katie, unlock the vault next week again and wipe off the cobwebs and bring me out again for another radio retrospective.
All right, I'll do it.
Have you forgotten the night that we met? With so much to remember, how could you forget the dreams I dreamed? to come.
Our own Katie Sewell and Steve Scherer, you remember his voice. And we have a wonderful look back at the golden years of radio every Thursday. And every Thursday, we also check in with our food writer, Sarah Dickerman. And she's graciously consented to come in. It's always fun when you're here.
Oh, I love being here.
It's,
it really is.
It's
fun.
Great to hear you. So you're taking us to Renton for lunch today.
I am. And I'll confess, I go to Renton for the same reason that many of you do, which is...
You go to IKEA?
The IKEA run.
So this is not the meatballs that we've heard iffy things about. We're not
right.
eating at IKEA.
I will confess to eating some IKEA meatballs in my day. But if you really want to eat well while you're down in Renton... Well, I think I've already mentioned Naan and Curry, which is a great Indian place. But there's also a wonderful... Buddhist Vietnamese vegetarian restaurant called Blossom.
And where is that exactly? Is it near IKEA?
It's not right near IKEA. It's more downtown Renton.
Okay, so you go to IKEA and you, or maybe on the way to IKEA.
If you could get off 167 on the way, or be enjoying Renton in any other number of fashions.
But that's true.
But.
So Blossom is a Vietnamese Buddhist vegetarian restaurant.
Yeah. And
what does that mean?
Well, I mean, it just means that that's sort of the driving force of the vegetarianism. But it's a place where you can go and get fake meat, okay. among other things. So, you can get simulated prawns and simulated mackerel and simulated beef. I don't tend to order those dishes, though there's nothing wrong with them. They're a great, gateway towards eating less meat. But they also make great things that aren't more... sort of simulating meat, and there's some of the best lemongrass tofu I've had, which is always one of my favorite dishes, no matter what. But it was really, really full of that lemongrass, that tang.
Is that a soup, or is that more...
No, that's a dry preparation, sort of squares of tofu.
Yum, yum.
And, just with that beautiful garlicky lemongrass, little chili, just a delicious, always a good thing to order at a Vietnamese restaurant. And then they also do the clay pots, those wonderful clay pots that come in a, big hot earthenware pot. And I had a recommendation to try the eggplant clay pot that comes with all sorts of vegetables, including eggplant, all sort of big chunks, a really rich, hearty stew with big chunks of tofu.
Mm.
And then, that characteristic flavor, though, that you would get in Vietnamese cooking is often from fish sauce. So, of course, this place doesn't use fish sauce.
Oh.
So they use other fermented products, including some fermented tofu, to give that richness.
So is it a little bit different taste than what we'd be used to in sort of the Vietnamese joints on the Ave?
A little bit different, but you get that funky umami comes from the fermentation, and it doesn't really matter what's fermenting.
Oh, it's not the fish.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, so
I mean, there's obviously, like I said, there's different range. There's a range of it, but you can get a lot of that earthy, full flavored meatiness, lack of a better word. With some of these other products.
You mentioned that you were recommended, that the eggplant was recommended. Who sent you to this place?
You know who recommended it was Eric Bond, who owns Monsoon Restaurant. And he said that he enjoys it. He lives down south, so he...
All right. Well, that's a pretty good tout for a restaurant. You thought you'd follow his advice.
Yeah, I took his advice.
Okay, so this is called Blossom Restaurant, and it's in downtown Renton.
Yeah, and they have a great courtyard, too. So it was a sunny day when I was there, lots of plants, and it was just a pleasant place to be.
Well, should we decide that we're not, if you're in Renton, this is easy for you, but if you live a little further away, maybe you're inspired to cook something vegetarian, and you've brought in a kind of a classic book today, yes?
Yeah, it's a really, I have to admit some of my fondness for this book comes from sort of its historical moment, too. It's a book published in 1930, I think, and it was a duke.
It's called The Duke's Table, by the way.
A Sicilian duke named Enrico Aliatta, and he was a vegetarian, a committed vegetarian, kind of a worldly guy. In looking at his biography, it seems like he was sort of a little new agey. He had...
In 1930s?
Oh, yeah. Well, think of all the progressives in Europe in the 1930s.
I guess.
You've got the Bauhaus going. You've got,
wow.
all sorts of avant-garde folks, in Italy. You'd have the futurists. So there's probably... a little of that worldliness going on. And he was really committed to vegetarianism as an ethical principle. And so he produced this cookbook, but it's very much a cookbook of its own era. And so you realize what people would have been eating that they would have been concerned about giving up.
Such as?
Perhaps tripe. So he simulates tripe by making these little pancakes and then putting them in a broth, you know, the sort of strips. or there's a vegetarian haggis in here.
So for those of us who didn't eat the non-vegetarian versions of that, I assume there's some other...
Right. I mean, there's actually a lot of other recipes that we'd be more likely to prepare. But as a document, it's really fun to read these others. So you can find he has lots of pizzas, pasta doughs. He was an early raw food advocate. So there's all sorts of these wonderful sort of gazpacho soups. There's a watermelon and cucumber soup.
Mm.
I tried a false chicken filling last night that I cooked up.
And what was that?
It was basically like a white sauce, a bechamel sauce, mm-hmm. with eggplants and walnuts in it and some little cheese and a little parsley.
I have to say, I did try a vegetarian bolognese sauce that mm-hmm. Giada De Laurentiis had online someplace, and it was great. But I think a lot harder than making the bolognese sauce with the meat.
Oh, yeah. There's labor in this. And this is very much a cookbook for someone who can kind of get along in the kitchen. He's a little bit loose with his directions.
Uh-oh.
That said, I think it's a really interesting document, especially if you're really committed to vegetarian cooking and you want to get a little historical context.
How did you hear of this book?
This is a publisher that I like a lot, the Melville House.
So did they re-release this?
Yeah, they did. Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of fascinating. You're making me think of Lynn Rossetto Casper's Splendid Table, which mm-hmm. I think is the book that she won her cookbook award for.
Yeah.
And that was another sort of attempt to go back and capture, I don't know, historic, traditional recipes.
Right. I mean, and she was going really back to some of those more medieval recipes, too. I think was that Emilia Romano?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the region she was covering.
And that's why this book fascinates me, or the idea of this book fascinates me, because Italy is so embedded with its culinary traditions.
Yeah, and remember, this is Sicily, so this is almost not even Italy. This is like all those Moorish traditions and Greek traditions that are passing through the seas at that time. So it's even, you get this very particularity, and I always recommend to people, you know, to even check out of the library, look through some historical cookbooks and just think about the way other people thought about food at a different moment.
But, well, this almost seems very contemporary because I'm also flashing forward. Mark Bittman was Steve Scherer's guest mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago talking about, I think the official title is Vegan Before Six, the name of his new mm-hmm. book. So this idea of both raw food and maybe even meatless Monday, mm-hmm. or you mentioned incorporating a little bit more mm-hmm. more vegetables into your diet. I mean, I imagine you having hundreds of volumes that maybe you're only going to make one thing from this book, or maybe you're going to look at it for inspiration. Mm-hmm. That idea of, well, you know, does that just mean I eat faux tripe or faux... Right. hamburger meat or whatever. So like the idea of sort of perusing all these texts.
It points you in a different direction. It gives you an inspiration. And, you know, if you're feeling dreary because you're stuck with, you know, whatever your vegetable dish of the week is, this is certainly a fun place to spark a little inspiration. I like I wouldn't say the fake chicken filling tasted like chicken to me, but it was a yummy, rich filling that gave a lot of heft to a meal that was all vegetables otherwise.
The book is called The Duke's Table, and it was originally published in 1930 by Enrico Aliata, the Duke of Salaparuta. Well, okay. And you can find this in a store these days.
Yes, or the online stores. Yeah.
Or you can just go to Renton to Blossom Vegetarian Restaurant, which is a Vietnamese restaurant run by a Buddhist nun, and that sounds fun, too, and maybe a little bit easier.
Either way.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food for a number of publications, including Slate, New York Times, Bon Appetit, among others. You can also find her at her own site, sarahdickerman.com, and here on Thursdays on Weekday on KUOW. It's so great to see you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us again tomorrow.
#10:59. What's going on with the process of putting in place a system for the legal growing and selling of marijuana in Washington state? An update on that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Consolidated Press, serving Seattle since 1934, offering full-color web, sheet-fed digital printing, binding, and mailing services. 206-447-9659 or on the web at consolidatedpress.com.
Here at The Story, we've been following the Somali refugee, Abdi Iftin. He recently sent me an email titled, Wow, a notice from the State Department saying he'd won a green card lottery.
It actually says you have been randomly selected out of millions of people.
Coming up in The Story, Abdi Iftin's chance at a new life and a conversation with the philanthropist Melinda Gates.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service called, appropriately enough, KUOW2. It's on HD radio and it's online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.